The road beyond the village was wider than the one that had brought Horace to the town, but it was still hard-packed dirt. The river ran alongside the highway, its brown waters rippled with a gentle current. Horace studied the big man in front of him. From the powerful muscles moving under his dark skin, he looked strong enough to haul Isiratu's wagon all by himself. Long scars crisscrossed his shoulders and down his back. Many of them were old and gray, almost blending into his skin, but a few showed the stark whiteness of being new. The man clearly wasn't a Keshian. Horace had heard of dark-skinned peoples who lived on the southern continent, but he'd always assumed they were myths.
I thought the stories about warlocks and sorcery were myths, too.
Judging by the sun's position in the sky, shining right into his eyes, the time was approaching mid-morning. They were traveling east again. To take his mind off his situation, Horace tried talking to the big man. He waited until the guards were bunched up near the front of the line.
Hey, can you understand me?
The giant didn't respond, but the pair of men chained in front of him looked back. The one on the left was about Horace's height, with a long, hawkish nose. He turned back, but the other man, short and spindly with a bald head, held Horace's gaze. Horace had a hard time guessing his age, but by the lines on his face, he had to be at least 40.
Yes! Are you—
A violent blow from a whip caught him across the side of the head. The guard drew back his arm for another whack as the little man held his bleeding face. A surge of anger overcame Horace. He ran forward and pushed in front of the victim. The whip cut into his raised forearm. Horace's fist connected with the guard's forehead, which was unfortunately protected by the low visor of his helmet. Horace recoiled from the burst of new pain across his knuckles. The guard kicked Horace's legs out from under him and put him on his back. Horace threw his arms over his head as the short whip beat up and down his body. He tried to roll away from the blows, but the neck chain kept him from going very far. When the beating ended, Horace's arms and legs were covered with painful welts. The guard stood over him. He started to get a foot under him when a large hand reached down. Horace took it and was lifted to his feet. The dark-skinned man looked even more formidable up close.
Oh, thank you.
The giant turned around without speaking. The guard glowered at them both, but kept his whip by his side, and the line resumed its march. It was long into the evening before a halt was called. While the soldiers made camp, the prisoners were herded together. The guards brought out wooden mallets and spiked the coffle chain to the ground. Then one sentry kept watch while the rest of the guards ate and relaxed. Horace collapsed to the ground. The smells of cooking were intoxicating, but he couldn't even summon the energy to sit up when a servant brought their evening meal. He sucked down the two ladles of water he was allowed and ate lying on his side. It was more of the flavorless mush, but he hardly cared. He longed for the solace of sleep and closed his eyes.
I am Kaz.
Hearing the words spoken in stilted Arnasi made Horace sit bolt upright. Beside him sat the short, bald target of the guard's abuse.
I'm Horace. You speak Arnasi?
Yes, a little. Good to meet you, Sire Horace.
Huh? Oh, yes. Good to meet you too. Are you a Keshian?
Indeed. I am born in Juguna. Will you please tell about your land? I am very want to know.
Sure. But first, where are they taking us?
We are on road to Nisus. We are a gift, yes? We are gift.
A gift for who?
Aman Amat Duri.
Is that another lord?
No, is the god Sun.
Gaz pointed up to the sky.
Sun, yes?
The sun. The sun god.
Gaz nodded while Horace tried to put the pieces together. They were being taken to a place where they would be given to a cult of sun worshippers.
If you're a Keshian, why are you a captive?
I'm very poor. You understand? Sell ox, sell farm, then nothing left to sell. Must sell self.
Wait, you sold yourself?
Yes. Master demanded it, or take my life. Better than death, yes?
Horace wasn't sure he agreed, but he kept that to himself. He spotted a copper disc hanging from Gaz's wrist by a thin leather cord. The disc had squiggly lines drawn on its flat surface.
What's that?
Gigim Libo, a charm against spirits. You get one, very could protect your ka from night demons.
What kind of hell is this place?
Yes, you are man of the gods. But we, Akeshii, see this as the natural way. The Zoanii rule from heights. The rest must suffer in this life. If we serve well, we be birthed again after our long resting. You understand?
On the far side of the slave ring, three guards were standing over a chained woman, one holding her by the hair. The nearest slaves cowered away from the spectacle as far as they could move. While the other guards watched, the woman's captor tore away her thin tunic. Horace could guess what was going to come next. He started to get up.
No, you must not!
To hell with that.
A few slaves looked up as Horace stood, but he saw no camaraderie in their eyes, only painful acceptance. Horace pulled on the chain attached to his collar as he took a long stride toward the disturbance. The guards took notice. The two watching the show advanced toward him, their hands going to the whips at their belts. The first blow caught him across the chin. He ducked under the follow-up, but the next one landed on his shoulder. Horace tried to lunge at the guards, hoping to knock them down, but the chain jerked him to a stop. He bent under a barrage of whip blows. When one of the guards grabbed him by the neck, Horace lunged and wrapped his arms around the man. They both tumbled to the ground, but the guard punched Horace several times. Bright spots exploded in front of his eyes as the guard lifted his whip. A large hand closed around the guard's wrist and hurled him backward. The giant waded into the brawl, throwing punches. Whips cut into his dark skin, but the big man didn't seem to notice. He picked up a guard by the throat and a leg and threw him into the campfire. Blinking to clear his vision, Horace climbed to his knees. Then something hard struck him across the shoulder. The breath rushed from his lungs as he pitched forward. A few paces away, the giant bowed under the weight of several soldiers who had joined in the fight. Horace covered up his face as the blows continued to fall. They beat him savagely and kicked him dozens of times in the ribs and back. Curled up in a tight ball, Horace lost all sense of time. The blows stopped falling, and there was only pain for what felt like hours. And then, nothing.
You live!
Horace cracked his eyelids and winced. The sun was only a couple of fingers above the horizon, but already its light was blinding. He started to sit up. And pain erupted all over his body. His entire back felt like one huge bruise.
Slow. Go slow. Here.
Gaz knelt beside him, holding out a cup. Horace accepted it and savored the warm water. Then he lay back.
What was I thinking last night? I wasn't thinking, just reacting. Again. What's gotten into me?
Must not drag attention to self.
Draw. Don't draw attention to yourself.
Yes. Hate them in your heart, but not show it. This is best.
The soldiers strode around the camp, packing up to depart. The big slave, who had come to his aid last night, sat a couple of paces away. Several new bruises marred his skin, but otherwise he looked little worse for wear. Then Horace turned his head. Several guards were approaching, with their whips held ready. The slaves rose. Horace began the slow process of standing up as the coffle was dragged and shoved into a semblance of order. The soldiers lined up in formation, and then everyone waited. Horace risked a glance over his shoulder to the elaborate pavilions where Lord Isiritu and his entourage had spent the night. A manservant emerged from the largest tent, a long wooden chest in his arms, and was soon followed by his masters, Lord Isiritu and Lord Ubar, and the priest Nasir. While Isiritu entered the wagon, his son walked to the center of the camp. Horace watched as the young noble closed his eyes and held out both hands at waist height. A dark spot appeared on the ground at Lord Ubar's feet. The spot grew wider and became a muddy puddle, A knee-high jet of water spurted from the wet earth. Ubar stepped away from the newly made spring, and several slaves approached with buckets, which they used to refill the caravan's water barrels. Then the procession started moving. The big man glanced back every once in a while. Horace caught one of these glances and acknowledged it with a nod. The big man did nothing in return.
He probably thinks I'm insane. He might be right.
Horace couldn't help but admire the man, who marched with a straight back and shoulders thrust back as if he were leading a victory parade. The nearby captives gave him as much space as their chains would allow, and even the guards left him alone. Horace tried to emulate him, standing up tall as he marched along. The sandy waste continued ahead of them for as far as he could see. This was, he comprehended with a shock, what they called a desert. He'd heard of such places. Apparently, the East was rampant with them. Great dry seas of sand where a man could die of thirst in hours.
What is this place?
The Iron Desert.
So, you speak Arnasi?
I'm better with Nemean. Arnasi is too hard. The words have too many meanings.
I'm Horace, from Arnos. From Tynes, specifically. What's your name?
Jerome, son of Kieran, of the Mojave clan.
Good to meet you, Jerome. Where are you?
A guard walked by, brandishing his whip, and Horace closed his mouth. Jerome faced forward as if nothing had passed between them. The procession stopped for a break at mid-morning. A man came around with the water barrel, and Horace gulped down the cup offered to him. Keeping an eye on the guards, Horace leaned over to Jerome, who lay beside him, stretched out on the hot sand.
So you're obviously not a Keshian. Where are you from?
The Zaral, far to the south and west.
How did you get all the way up here? It has to be at least 500 leagues.
Closer to 1,000, but I've been farther from my homeland than this.
That's incredible.
Horace gestured to the man's iron collar.
So, what happened?
I ended up on the wrong side of the wrong war. I was given the choice between death and becoming a slave. Now, I fight for our master's pleasure.
Do you have a wife back in the Zaral? Children?
No. No one.
So, what lies ahead for us?
I've heard that the priests of Akeshia worship their gods with blood. Perhaps we go to our deaths on their altars. But I won't kneel for them like a goat. They'll have to fight if they want to feed me to their demons.
After a short rest, the caravan resumed its trek. The sand dunes became taller until they often blocked out the horizon like long, rippling hills. Not long after high noon, the caravan was reaching the top of a dune when Horace spotted a pair of reddish-brown dots on the horizon ahead. The spots grew with each passing mile, from small pebbles to narrow boulders, until they were finally revealed as towering pillars of rock. Eventually, Horace began to notice features carved into the stones. They were statues.
Holy God!
The road passed between the statues, giving Horace the chance to see them up close. The colossus on the left was male, the one on the right, female. Both were carved standing up. Horace wondered who they were supposed to be. He was so preoccupied with the statues, he didn't notice the view beyond them. He turned forward and looked down into the canyon of deep red stone that opened before them. Lord Isiritu's wagon had already started down the road, which cut through the center of the valley. But Horace's gaze was drawn to the structures built along the steep walls on either side. They looked like stone palaces, scores of them. Most had extravagant entrances, with columned arcades and statuary, surrounded by high walls. A few of the larger edifices had two or even three layers of concentric fortifications. Yet he saw no people among the buildings.
The Valley of Souls.
What is it?
A city of tombs.
The caravan halted midway across the valley at a square platform beside the road. The square was made from a deep red stone shot through with black veins. Lord Isiritu's wagon had pulled up beside it while the guards spread out to make camp on the opposite side of the road. The sky turned deep lavender as the sun went down behind the canyon walls, and long shadows reached across the tombs, shrouding them in gloom. Lord Isiritu, his son, and Nasir emerged from the wagon. Usually when they stopped for the night, the lords retired directly to their tents to eat and bathe. But tonight, they climbed onto the platform and knelt in the dust with their heads bowed. Braziers were produced and set alight at each corner. Horus felt warmth coming from the direction of the platform, though the braziers were more than a dozen yards away and the temperature on the valley floor was dropping. The warmth played along his skin like the touch of a furnace. Thinking it might be heat sickness, he sat down. Finally, the ritual ended. By that time, the tents had been erected and the masters went inside. The guards came around with water and hard bread for the slaves. Jerome sat down beside Horus.
Want company?
Sure, I'd be glad for it. This place is beyond belief.
The Akeshii buried their dead in stone mansions if they're rich enough, or in the dirt if not. They believe their souls pass down into the earth to the afterworld to be judged.
Whatever the reason for these tombs, I never thought I'd see any place like this. Makes me feel small. Like a child getting his first glimpse of the ocean, except here the drops of water are measured in years. Some of these temples must be centuries old.
Older than that. These high walls protect the tombs from the winds and weather. They'll still be sitting here when the world ends.
And here we sit before them, a couple of slaves on our way to discover our fates. So, how does a man from the southern continent find himself here?
It's a long tale.
I'm a good listener.
I was with a mercenary unit out of Maganu, one of the few sane outfits to come out of that death-loving country. After putting down an uprising in Balos, we were hired by an expatriated prince of Isuran to take back his city. The enemy was a rival prince with dreams of empire. The sacking took only 2 days, but that's when the real trouble began. An Akeshian legion showed up on the doorstep. What we didn't know was that our royal employer had received an Akeshian envoy the previous year and had hung him from the city walls as a testament to his independence. The Akeshii had returned to answer the insult in blood. Our employer, of course, demanded our protection. You can guess what happened next.
The Akeshians took the city?
Aye. They had us outnumbered more than 10-1. At the end, I killed our employer for betraying us, but most of my unit was dead by then. The conquerors gave me a choice. The collar or the stake. I chose to live. You and I are survivors. Alike in mind, I think.
I don't know about that. You're the scariest man I've ever met. I'm just a sailor.
No. I don't know much about you, but I already know you are more than that. You have a strong spirit. Sleep well, Horus of Tynes.
Good night, Jerome of the Zaral.
The caravan left the Valley of Souls before dawn, hastening up the canyon road and onto the desert plain, as if in a rush to put the city of the dead behind it. Dark clouds gathered in the east.
Feels like we're marching into the ovens of hell.
I would suggest you pray, but even the gods aren't crazy enough to visit here. Be strong. Focus on the ground in front of you. Don't think about the individual steps.
You talk like you've done this before.
Many times. You have to march to find work when you're a mercenary.
Horus studied the clouds ahead. At first, he thought it was a trick of the morning light, but now he noticed they were a strange green hue. They grew darker and taller with the passing minutes, until Horus realized they were coming in this direction, fast. The soldiers hurried to surround the wagon. Some took spikes and hammers from their packs, and others retrieved coils of rope. Working quickly, they threw the ropes over the wagon and spiked both ends to the ground. The drivers rushed to cover the draft animals with tarpaulins. The slaves dropped to the ground. Horus followed along, but he and Jerome stayed up on their knees to see while the others pressed their faces to the sand. The clouds were still approaching. Every few seconds, an emerald glow would highlight their billowing masses. Within minutes, the sky was awash in roiling clouds. Sand flew in all directions as the storm smashed into the procession. At the front of the caravan, the soldiers huddled around the wagon as if to protect its wooden sides with their bodies, but several of them scurried back as the wagon door opened. Lord Isiritu and Lord Ubar climbed down. Horus watched, shading his eyes with both hands as the two noblemen walked out in front of the procession. The two noblemen stopped 20 yards ahead of the lead oxen. Lord Isiritu raised his right hand toward the clouds. A tingling warmth suffused Horus's chest directly behind his breastbone. At the same time, a powerful urge gnawed at the back of his mind, a yearning to lash out, to scream and rage and destroy.
What the hell is happening to me?
Then a blast of wind slammed into him. Unprepared for its force, Horus tumbled backward. He managed to get to his knees, but he froze as a solid wall of sand rose from the desert floor. The wall grew into a semicircular rampart, curving around Lords Isiridu and Ubar and the front of the procession. The wind abated for a moment. Then the wall exploded, crumbling to the ground. Horus tried crawling back to the huddled slaves. The sand slipped away beneath him. He felt himself sliding backward. Then a strong grip seized his wrist. Jaram pulled him back into the crowd of cowering slaves. Horus nodded in thanks. The big man smiled back. Ahead of them, the wagon rocked from side to side. Isiridu and Ubar stood firm against the storm's fury. The pain in Horus's chest returned. The storm clouds overhead turned midnight black. Emerald bolts of light passed between them, almost too fast to see. Horus didn't realize he had stood up until he felt the hand tugging his arm. Jaram kept a strong hold on him, but Horus pulled free and rose to his full height. He sensed some sort of connection to the storm, as if the energy flowing through him was reflected in the clouds above, or maybe it was the other way around. He reached up with his fingers spread. A blinding light exploded in front of his eyes. The alien energy continued to pour out of him, or into him. He didn't understand what was happening. He wanted it all to just...
Stop!
The wind suddenly disappeared. The wagon settled down, and the whipping sand wafted back to the ground. Horus looked around. The sky was clear once more. Lord Isiridu was on his knees, his head bowed. Streaks of blood ran down his face. Ubar stooped beside his father, blood staining several spots on his robe. The soldiers left the cover of the wagon to surround the nobles, helping Isiridu to his feet. Lord Ubar assisted too, but his gaze was focused on the slave line, staring right at Horus. As the soldiers helped their masters back to the wagon, the other slaves backed away from him, as far as the chain allowed. Even Gaz. Only Jaram seemed unconcerned. He had turned around to face the wagon. Horus looked down at his hands. The vibrations were gone, the surge of energy departed, but he couldn't forget what it had felt like coursing through him. He'd never experienced anything like it before. He had stopped the storm with nothing more than his mind. It was insane, and yet he had no other explanation. Horus's stomach rolled over as he saw Lord Ubar approaching with four soldiers. He started to get up, but the soldiers raced ahead, drawing swords as they formed a line between him and the young noble. Ubar pushed past his guardians. The young noble pointed to the now clear sky.
Sar, Shamana Katia.
The storm. He wants to know what you did.
Horus wanted to shout that he didn't know, but he was too tired to fight. He held out his hands, palms up. They looked normal, showing no sign of the power that had flowed through them only minutes ago. Ubar nodded, and then he motioned to one of the soldiers, who put away his weapon and brought out a set of long iron tongs and a hammer. Horus flinched when the soldiers came over to him, but held still as he understood what they wanted. In a few moments, his collar came off. Horus felt his bare neck as the soldiers stepped back. Ubar gestured to the front of the procession. Then he and two of his bodyguards went back to the wagon. The other two remained with Horus. They put their swords away, but otherwise gave every indication of watching over him. Jaram stood up. The other slaves were getting up too, but they kept their distance.
What happened?
You are a free man.
But why? What did he say?
They don't know what to do with you. You're a slave and a foreigner, but you also have Zoanna, so you can't be a slave. He wants you to remain with the caravan until Lord Isiridu makes a judgment.
What's a Zoanna? What kind of judgment?
Before Jaram could answer, the guards returned. The slaves started moving after the wagon again. Jaram gave Horus a resigned look before following the coffle. Horus watched the caravan go, not sure what he was supposed to do. If he was truly free, he could leave. Yet he doubted the soldiers were going to let him walk away, free or not, especially with this talk of Zoanna, whatever it was. With an eye on the horizon, he set off after the procession. The caravan stopped at a small oasis of palm trees around a burbling spring. Jaram sat across from Horus. The other slaves refused to talk to him. Even Gaz wouldn't look him in the eye.
Zoanna is black magic.
What?
The power that our masters wield, they call it Zoanna.
And they think that I...
The idea was so far beyond Horus's existence that he had a hard time crediting it. Magic was the stuff of legends about the elder days when terrible monsters supposedly walked the land. No one believed in such things anymore. Yet these people did, and they believed he possessed it. At first, he told himself that he was no different now than he had been before, but he knew it wasn't true.
No, there is something different about me. Something changed during that sandstorm.
He looked over at the pavilion erected between the tall trees. Lord Isiritu had been transferred from the wagon to the huge tent.
What made those gouges on Isiritu's face? I've seen it happen before.
They get those wounds when they use their sorcery.
Who gets them?
People like you who wield the Zoanna. Sorcerers.
I'm no damn magician.
We all saw what you did. You turned away the storm with your magic. That is why the lords fear you now.
Huh. If the lords truly fear me, I can use that.
A soldier approached from the direction of the tents. The slaves looked up with apprehension as the trooper stopped in front of Horus and held out a wooden bowl covered with a linen cloth. Horus took the covered bowl. It was cool, as if it had been kept on ice. As the soldier walked away, Horus pulled away the cloth. Inside were half a dozen small white eggs on a bed of lettuce.
What's this for?
A sign of respect, a gift to honor what you did.
Horus took an egg and put it in his mouth. He offered the bowl to Jaram, who took an egg and plopped it into his mouth with a smile. He also offered some to Gaz and the other slaves, but they turned away. While he and Jaram shared the meal under the dimming sky, Horus learned how Jaram had served in several armies before he was captured by the Akeshians, and how he'd fought in the arena. Jaram wasn't so forthcoming about the circumstances that had led to him being attached to this lot of slaves, but after the big man went to sleep, Gaz shuffled over to Horus.
The brand on Jaram's cheek marks him a murderer. Such men not to be trusted.
Two soldiers came over and motioned for Horus to accompany them. He complied and followed them. They led him through the camp to a smaller tent staked out beside Lord Isiritu's pavilion and indicated he should enter the tent that had been erected for Lord Ubar and was guarded by a cordon of bodyguards. Horus ducked inside. Two lamps sat on the tent's floor, which was covered in thick carpet from wall to wall. Lord Ubar sat on a broad cushion. He wore a clean purple coat brocaded with silver thread. His hair had been brushed and oiled. Nasir sat beside Lord Ubar, wearing a crimson stole over his robe. Ubar gestured to the floor.
Please, sit.
A slave girl, quite fetching with her black hair held back with jade pins, rushed forward to place a cushion in front of Horus. With a nod to her, he sat down.
Thank you for the extra food, and for my freedom.
Ubar nodded, seeming pleased with the thanks, but puzzled by the mention of freedom.
It is the law that Zoanii cannot be enslaved. Please forgive me, Inganas, but you are an outlander and possibly a spy.
What did he say?
Inganas. It means he who does not bleed. I believe it refers to your lack of Immaculata after the storm.
Yes, about the Immaculata. What?
Lord Ubar says, my father is still recovering from the storm of chaos. But when he is well, he will decide your final status. Until then, you will remain free, but under guard. Who are the most powerful Zoanii in your country? Do they all support the invasion of our land? Is the Zoanna common in your country? Where were you trained?
Hold on. I don't understand most of what you just asked me.
Please tell us which questions you did not understand.
You can start by explaining the Zoanii and Zoanna. One of the slaves said it meant sorcery. Is that what you think I am?
Zoanii are the rulers of the Empire. Zoanna is... The closest word in Anasi would be magic. However, it also has a divine connotation. Zoana comes from the celestial realm, where the gods dwell in perfection, and the Zoaniai are their instruments in this world.
So, are you and Lord Ubar both Zoaniai?
His Highness, Lord Ubar, is Zoaniai like his noble father. I am not. Now, if you please, Lord Ubar has many questions regarding your homeland and its customs, and also about yourself.
Tell him that I honestly don't know anything about this Zoana. Like I told his father, I'm just a simple craftsman. I build and repair ships.
Alakti ka'anu Zoana akekalata hisu. Hisu ka'anu inaptum.
May I ask a question, my lords?
Yes.
The other prisoners say you're taking us to a place called Nisus. Is that right?
Kipars in Nisus.
Sar Alakti, minu shumana amur.
Yes, Lord Desiratu has honored the Temple of Amur with a gift.
And will we, the captives, be killed?
That is the talk of foolish peasants. Most of them will live their remaining years serving in the temple or tending the olive groves.
You say most, but not all? Me, for example. Why send a foreigner to this temple?
Kima Parsi, Desiratu, sir.
Lord Ubar says that is his father's prerogative. Once you landed on his father's domain, you became his property. Yet things may have changed. He asked you here tonight for another purpose.
Alaktika Anu Harani Sekanu Alaktasa?
Lord Ubar says, please, with all humility I ask, may I examine you?
I suppose that would be...
The tent flap opened and two soldiers appeared. They faced Lord Ubar.
Isiratu Ulukor, Alaktasa Sekanu Alak.
Is something wrong?
You have been summoned by Lord Isiratu. You are to go at once.
Horus stood and left the tent with the soldiers. Lord Ubar and Nasir followed them out. Horus accompanied the soldiers to the pavilion. The door flaps were held open by soldiers. Inside the pavilion, Lord Isiratu reclined on a bed of cushions. Both of the nobleman's arms were wrapped in bandages. A long gash, stitched closed, ran from his left temple down to the corner of his mouth. Lord Ubar and Nasir bowed as they entered and took seats to the left of Isiratu. To the noble's right was an old man who sat with a hunch, as if his spine couldn't support his slender frame. The stranger wore a long robe of purple, so dark it almost looked black. His head was shaved bald, like Isiratu's. No cushion was provided for Horus, so he stood while Isiratu talked with the new arrival. Ubar and Nasir sat attentively, but said nothing. The old man stood up with assistance from one of his soldiers. As he turned to the exit, Horus saw a huge scar of twisting brown and gray lines dominating the right side of his face. The old man limped out the door.
Who was that?
That was Lord Mulsibar, High Vizier of Erugash.
What's Erugash?
Lord Isiratu leaned over to his son and punctuated his speech by violent hand gestures.
Lord Isiratu has decided that we shall go to Erugash instead of Nisus.
So Erugash is a place?
Erugash is the city of Queen Byleth. In your society, she would be Lord Isiratu's liege lord.
Why the sudden change of plans? Is it because of the new lord? What was his name?
Lord Mulsibar shall accompany us on the journey.
Isiratu clapped, and a pair of soldiers escorted Horus out of the pavilion. When the caravan started off again, Jiram fell back to walk beside Horus. The soldiers guarding Horus didn't appear to care, so he risked some conversation.
What do you think about our new destination?
It makes little difference to me. I have wanted to see Erugash, though I always imagined it would be at the head of a conquering army.
Will it be the executioner's block for us, then?
I don't think you need to worry. If they wanted you dead, you would not be here.
What about the rest of you? Has Isiratu changed his plans about giving you away?
What will happen, will happen.
The caravan started up a long rise. Horus shaded his eyes to see to the top and then wished he hadn't. A cluster of poles crowned the low hilltop. No, not poles. Stakes, more than a dozen of them. A body hung from each. As the caravan approached the gruesome display, Horus noticed that most of the corpses were men, but he saw a couple of women, too. All of them stripped nude and impaled through the back, so that the pointed end of the stake protruded from their stomachs. Long, bloody tracks covered the bodies where they had been scourged before being impaled.
Who are they?
Slaves. Likely they tried to escape or stole from their masters.
Why haven't you tried to escape?
Where would I go? I have been running a long time, but everywhere is much like what I left behind, or worse. I've begun to wonder if the guards are testing me. Perhaps if I stay this time and let my path unfold, they will reward me.
With what? Freedom?
One way or the other, we will all be free in the end.
They passed beyond the impaled bodies. On the other side of the hill, the bleached sands gave way to a lush countryside. The earth was dark and rich, tilled into neat squares of gold, russet, and green. The road extended for miles through these fields, until it reached a great city on the horizon. Its walls gleamed like beaten copper in the sun. Even from this distance, Horace could tell the city was much larger than Avis back home. His elevated vantage allowed him to see a maze of white, flat rooftops and golden spires, but none of the buildings compared to the mammoth construction that rose from the center, grander than anything he had ever seen before. It was shaped like a pyramid, with several tiers rising high above the metropolis. A shimmering ribbon of green water cut through the city in a channel that fed a large lake north of the pyramid. The waterway joined to a mighty river running along the southern wall. The leagues between the Tor and the city passed quickly. After being passed by gate wardens through a long tunnel that passed under the walls and into a huge walled square, the caravan trundled along a broad avenue paved in hard clay, wide enough to allow three or even four wagons to drive side by side, if not for all the people that streamed along in both directions. The city dwellers wore garments of dyed linen, like schools of multicolored fish. Many of the men went bare-chested, wearing only long wraps around their waists and sandals. The women wore sleeveless shirts and tunics, but their skirts were often shorter than those of the men, rising above their knees. Horace was more shocked by the number of iron collars in the crowd. It seemed to him as if half the passers-by were slaves. Many had the same bronze complexion as their Akeshian masters, but he spotted slaves of lighter and darker browns, too. Both men and women wore collars, and even a few children, which shouldn't have surprised him, but it did. Most of the buildings were made of brick. Many doors were sunken into the street, some fully hidden so that they could only be accessed by sheer flights of steps. The building facades gave off waves of heat even as the sun sank out of sight, and the clay underfoot was warm through the soles of Horace's sandals. The procession stopped before a broad building with a beautiful facing of marble columns, each carved to resemble a woman with her arms lifted above her head to hold up the portico roof. The guards moved the slaves against the wall as the wagon door opened and Lord Isiritu emerged. Ubar and Nasir awaited him, but the nobleman brushed past and entered the building before them. The soldiers fell in behind. A party of men approached. Five wore bronze breastplates, polished to a brilliant shine, and had swords at their sides. Two were older men in robes. The two elders walked down the line of slaves, examining each man and woman. They paused a moment when they got to Jaram, pointing to the mark on his face. But when they got to Horace at the end, they hardly glanced at him before retreating a few paces to confer. After a brief conversation, the caravan guards unhooked the majority of the slaves, including Gaz. The soldiers herded the chosen slaves toward the northern end of the square, where several large wooden platforms stood. Auction blocks, Horace guessed. Jaram and five other male slaves were left behind.
What are they doing?
Culling.
What's that?
When an animal gets sick, it must be separated from the rest. Or if it is unfit to breed, it is taken away.
So which are we? The sick or the unfit?
I think we'll soon find out.
As if summoned by his words, the guards came for Jaram and the last slaves. Horace started to go with them, but the guards held out their hands.
Be strong.
You too. Maybe we'll meet again someday.
Perhaps.
As Jaram and the last slaves were taken to the tall wagons, Horace expected to learn his fate. However, the old men turned and departed, leaving him alone with his guards. He glanced around. The soldiers weren't paying much attention to him. The crowd made way for a white palanquin carried by a team of 8 burly men. Opaque curtains hid the occupants from view, but Horus's guards drew themselves up straight, arms by their sides, eyes forward. The sedan chair drew up in front of Horus. The bearers stopped in unison. A guard opened the door and stood aside. Horus looked at him, and the guard nodded. The interior was vacant, just 2 empty bench seats. Horus glanced back at the building with all its windows and the carved columns. Then, without any idea where he was being taken, he climbed inside the chair. Alira hugged the satchel to her chest as she closed the door to the armory. She had just enough time before the second bell to get to her secret cache and back again before she was expected in the Queen's chambers. She dared not be late again for Hetta's sake. She stole down the empty corridor in the direction of the slaves' quarters, where there was an exit near her hiding spot. The main level of the palace was empty this time of day, except for slaves assigned to cleaning duties, which was why she'd picked now to visit the armory. By mid-morning, these halls would be overflowing with diplomats and petitioners, with nobles and their prodigious entourages. The audiences and meetings would continue well into evening, when formal matters of state gave way to frolics and feasting and other entertainments. After 3 years as a chamber slave, Alira had ceased to think of the palace as just the home of the queen. It was more like a carnival for the lascivious and the disturbed that never ended. Marble squares of black and vermilion covered the hallway's floor. Artful decorations in bronze and iron hung on the stone walls. While the outer chambers were rich in natural light from many windows and skylights, Alira was glad that these interior corridors were dim. Officially, she wasn't supposed to be in this part of the palace, but as one of the queen's handmaidens, she had more access than most of the other slaves. But she didn't wish to rely on that flimsy protection if she got caught, especially because she was more than just a household servant. She had been sent by the neighboring nation of Nemedia to root out signs of Akeshian aggression against that country. 3 years was a long time to live among one's enemies, serving them, suffering under their heel, but she believed in her mission with all her heart. Her father had been the governor of an Arnasi colony on the island of Time when the Akeshians attacked. He'd died, giving Alira and her mother a chance to escape. After the Nemedian secret police took them in, she gladly joined their network to fight the empire that had destroyed her family. She approached an intersection between 2 large drawing rooms and froze. She realized the sounds were coming from behind her. She threw herself into a shallow niche and hid behind a marble bust of King Ubenhezard. She pressed herself deeper into the niche as someone passed by. She waited for several frantic heartbeats before peeking out. A black cloak fluttered behind a tall man as he strode down the corridor. It was Lord Astapta, one of the queen's chief viziers. As he disappeared around a corner, Alira knew she should turn around and head in the opposite direction. But instead, she kicked off her slippers. Holding the satchel with care to keep its contents from clanking together, she stole after the vizier barefoot. She didn't want to even think about the ramifications if she was discovered. But this was also a golden opportunity. Lord Astapta was the most mysterious man in the city. No one knew where he came from, although rumors were rife, but within a few months of his arrival, he had risen to the top of the social ladder to become the queen's highest servant. Rarely seen at court functions, he dwelled in the catacombs beneath the palace. Alira had long wondered what he did down there and why the queen favored him, but opportunities to find out were so rare that when faced with one, like now, she had to take it. Alira hurried down the corridor, deeper into the interior of the palace. Small lamps glowed high up on the walls. She avoided their pools of light as best she could, while following Lord Astapta into a part of the palace she had never seen before. They were far from the slave quarters and ever farther from the kitchens. If she were caught here, she'd have very few excuses as to why she had wandered so far from her assigned duties. Biting her bottom lip, she pressed on. The vizier turned down a dark corridor. After a dozen steps, Alira lost sight of him. She kept close to the left-hand wall, trailing her fingers along its stones to keep her sense of direction as she followed Lord Astapta's heavy strides. Then the strides drifted off to her right, and Alira barely stopped in time to keep from walking face first into a wall. She felt the corner and turned with it. A thought struck her as she trailed after the footsteps.
How is Lord Astapta finding his way without a light? He must have the route memorized. But why not carry a candle? Why the secrecy?
She continued onward through the dark. The satchel was getting heavy, but leaving it behind was out of the question. Lost in her thoughts, Alira halted in mid-stride as a cold shiver ran through her body. She strained to hear the slightest sounds, but there was nothing.
Where is he? Am I discovered?
She cursed herself for not paying more attention. Vibrations ran up through Alira's bare soles. She remained perfectly still, afraid to move. Not sure what she was doing, Alira inched forward with one hand extended in front of her. Her fingers touched a moving surface. It was stone and very large. Running her hands up and down, she determined that it was a door, and it was closing before her. She hurried to reach the opening, but it was narrow and shutting quickly. She had only a moment to decide.
Should I wait for another time? What if there isn't another time?
The door settled into its frame. She had missed it. Alira rested her forehead against the stone. As she berated herself, she noticed that the surface was warm. She put down her satchel and ran both hands across the door's smooth face. It was definitely warmer than the surrounding stone, almost hot, in fact.
What is behind it?
There was no handle or latch in the expected place. Alira searched for an opening mechanism. She started to dart back up the corridor to the last intersection, but then remembered her satchel and ran back to it, searching along the floor until her hands bumped into the coarse burlap. Clutching the bag, she sprinted down the corridor. She stopped at the intersection and listened. It sounded like they were coming from her right, but she couldn't be sure. If she guessed wrong, she would run directly into them, and that was trouble she didn't need. She slipped into the left-hand corridor, ran a few steps, and then pressed her back against a wall. A spot of orange light appeared in the darkness. It bobbed like a hot coal on the end of a fishing line, but showed enough for her to see their approaching faces. She had run into Xiantu and Gilgun. The twin brothers were two of the most notorious members of the court. Many referred to them in private as the Queen's Hounds. They served as Her Majesty's enforcers, and their penchant for cruelty was legendary. Alira retreated deeper into the darkness. There was nowhere to hide, and no way that she could escape from magicians of their caliber if she was discovered. The twins turned the corner in another direction. Now she could go back to searching for a way to open the stone door. She hurried back toward the intersection, but she had gotten halfway when something stopped her.
I'm late!
She turned and ran, cursing herself the entire way. The second bell was finished before she got back to the lighted corridors. The appearance of daylight ahead made her breathe easier. Following a corridor reserved for slaves, she almost stepped into the grand atrium before she realized she was still holding the satchel. It was too late to get it to her hiding spot. Looking around, she found a service closet and tucked it onto the highest shelf behind a pair of buckets. With a prayer that the sack and its contents would remain hidden until she could return to fetch them, she went out to face the consequences of her tardiness. She arrived at the Queen's residence on the top tier of the palace. The royal suite had its own foyer, bedecked with fine furniture and a collection of erotic sculpture. A squad of brawny bodyguards stood at attention, their tulwars held in perpetual readiness. Alira slipped through the inner doorway, hoping, praying, that she would arrive unnoticed.
Ah, my errant handmaiden arrives at last.
Alira froze on the threshold of the main parlor. The voice came from the doorway to her right.
Alira, come. I'm getting a chill.
The queen's bathing chamber was as large as the house Alira and her mother had shared in Nemedia. Every surface was faced in pink marble, including the floor and arched ceiling. The bathing tub set into the floor could have held a dozen people. The queen stood at the edge of the tub. Rivulets of soapy water ran down her exquisite body. Tall, with long, firm legs and a thin waist, she looked like a dancer. Her long black hair hung in wet ropes about her slim shoulders. Alira kept her head down as she took a towel from a nearby bench and attended the queen, drying her gently before wrapping the towel around Her Majesty's body. She used a smaller towel to cover the royal hair.
Thank you, child. Now come.
Alira followed the queen through the sitting room and into one of the suite's three lounge chambers. This one was decorated in shades of red and pink with white accents. Plush couches piled with pillows were arranged around the room. This was where the queen often entertained her male guests. Alira stopped short when she saw who was chained against the far wall.
Hera!
I don't know how many times I've told you, Alira.
The queen walked up to Hera. The girl was only 10 years old and as skinny as an alley cat, but beautiful with her olive skin. The queen ran her fingers down the girl's bare back.
You must be on time when I have my morning bath.
Alira rushed forward and fell to her knees.
Yes, Majesty, please forgive me. The blame is all mine. Please do not punish.
Shh! You know that I must punish you. How else will you learn your lesson?
Yes, Majesty. Please let Hera go and punish me. I take full responsibility for my lateness.
Silly child. This is how you learn.
The queen's personal torturer had brought a case of whips and canes that she set at Her Majesty's feet. The queen pulled Alira over to the nearest couch.
The red one, to begin with.
Hera, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
As the blows began to fall, the queen held Alira close and forced her to watch the spectacle. Horus lounged in the tub with his eyes closed, enjoying the warm water as it lapped against his chest and leached the aches from his tired muscles.
This is surely heaven. And if it's not, let me die now.
After climbing aboard the mysterious sedan, he had been carried out of the plaza and down a broad avenue where he got a better view of the city. Everything was built in tiers, the buildings and ramps rising like stone hills all around him. There were green spots, too, with gardens growing on rooftops and balconied terraces. The avenue crossed several bridges under which flowed narrow channels of water. After about a quarter of a mile, the sedan turned into a courtyard surrounded by high walls that blocked out most of the city. A squad of soldiers in indigo uniforms met Horus as he stepped out and ushered him inside a huge manor house. The soldiers took him upward instead, climbing several flights of steps and one long spiral staircase to a well-appointed room. They left him there. Exploring this cell hadn't taken him long. The room was a circle. Two windows showed views of the city below. Several larger buildings stood out, many of them topped with broad domes. He'd stood at those windows as the twilight deepened, watching the moon rise to take its place among the stars. Finally, too tired to stand any longer, he had collapsed into the bed. Waking up on the fluffy mattress had been so luxurious that he didn't rush to get up, even as dawn's rays stretched across the floor. He might have stayed in bed all day, but for the entrance of four serving men. Their collars advertised them as slaves, but they wore clothing of fine linen and supple leather sandals, like men of means. Though they did not speak his language, they made their wishes clear, and within an hour, Horus had been shaved, barbered, and set to soak in a copper bathtub. The door opened again, but instead of slaves, three soldiers stepped inside. Each man held a sword with a curved blade, like a scimitar, but with a more pronounced arc. Horus sat up, dropping one hand to cover his privates and feeling quite defenseless. A moment later, the slaves re-entered. They laid out an outfit on the bed as a stooped figure appeared in the doorway. Lord Mulcibar's limp was more pronounced as he entered. Horus remained in place. Then Lord Mulcibar surprised him by speaking in passable Nemean.
I wanted to formally make your acquaintance.
That's very nice of you, my lord.
I am Mulcibar Fardhun Etalulu.
Horus Delrosa, at your service.
Have you been made comfortable?
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you for your hospitality. It's a far cry from running across the desert.
I suppose it must be. I would ask your indulgence for Lord Isiratu, but I am of the opinion that the man is a slug.
So, this is your house?
Yes. It was originally the royal palace of Eragash, but it was bequeathed to my grandfather.
Does that make you royalty?
Yes. although some have said that the bloodline has thinned in recent generations. Please put on this attire. I will send for you within the hour.
Send for me for what, my lord? Are we going somewhere?
Yes, you have been summoned to the palace. The queen wishes to examine you.
Once again, Horus rode in the palanquin, this time across from Lord Mulcibar. He lifted a hand to scratch his nose. Each of his wrists was encircled by a wide cuff of silvery metal, joined together by a 12-inch chain of the same material. Before they left his mansion, Lord Mulcibar had apologized while his soldiers placed the manacles on Horus, explaining that it had to be done. The metal was too heavy to be silver, weighing his arms down like lead. Besides the chains, Horus wore a fine suit of dark gray linen. In an odd turn, the sandals he'd worn since the fishing village had been replaced with a pair of black leather boots.
What are these chains made of?
They're made from Zohar Hadid. It translates to star metal. The metal is very rare, coming from stones that fell from the sky.
Why use it for chains?
Zohar Hadid restricts the flow of ethereal energies. All rogue magicians are chained thus when they are brought before a tribunal. Or, in this case, the Queen's court.
So what's she like?
Pardon?
The Queen. What is she like in person?
She is a goddess in the flesh, without peer, flawless.
Is there a king, too?
Queen Violet inherited the throne from her father and is not yet married. She is betrothed, however.
Violet? That's a pretty name.
Pray you don't say as much to Her Exalted Highness in court.
Can you teach me to say hello in your tongue?
You would say Sobhetu, which means the evening is well.
The sedan stopped. The door was opened by a young footman in purple livery.
One piece of advice. Be honest. Many have tried to dissemble with Her Majesty, and they all paid for it.
The chamber that a dozen guardsmen escorted Mulcibar and Horus to was cavernous. They had been joined by two twins who had conferred with Mulcibar in the corridor outside. Horus stood on what looked like an acre of white marble. Rows of colossal pillars festooned with golden scrollwork marched down the sides of the hall. Sunlight poured down from dozens of skylights to illuminate a raised platform at the end of the chamber. The platform, like the palace itself, had several tiers. A squad of soldiers stood along the bottom, their features hidden behind full helmets. Above them sat 12 old men in somber scarlet robes. A magnificent ivory and gold throne rested on the highest tier. The seat was vacant. Behind it, a purple curtain spanned the entire back wall. A crowd waited in the chamber, all bedecked in splendid apparel and jewels. The men favored elaborate tunics with short capes. The women were garbed in long, flowing dresses that, despite being sheer where the fabric wasn't gathered, were almost plain in comparison with the men's attire. The women also wore pigments around their eyes in a variety of shades. Everyone moved out of the way as the twins led the procession. Horus didn't flinch from the glances cast in his direction as he marched into the hall. A cool draft circulated through the chamber, such as he had experienced at Lord Isiritu's palace. Horus noticed a familiar face. Lord Isiritu stood at the front of the platform, flanked by his son Ubar and Nasir. Ubar wore the same quizzical expression he'd shown often during the trek to Aragosh. Yet both Lord Isiritu and Nasir stood stone-faced, like first-day recruits being reviewed by the High Marshal of the King's army. The robed twins ascended to the step just below the empty throne and turned to face the throng. The curtain parted and two people emerged, a man and a woman walking arm in arm. The man was draped in a white silk tunic, open at the chest to reveal a large golden amulet in the shape of a blazing sun. Yet it was the woman who drew Horus's attention. A purple silk gown covered her from the neck down. Tearing his gaze away from her outfit, Horus looked into her face and was enthralled all over again. Her features were narrow, refined, but her eyes were wide and dark, outlined in black kohl. Her rich midnight hair was braided and piled in a tower atop her head, the plaits interwoven with slender golden chains in a look both stunning and demure at the same time. This could be no other than the Queen of Aragosh. The entire crowd fell to its knees, lords and ladies alike, as she took her place on the throne. The man sat on a smaller chair beside her. Horus reluctantly kneeled as the queen spoke to Mulcibar.
Alaktika anuasar harani minu.
Master Horus, the queen wishes to know how you came to this land and with what intentions.
Sope etu, your excellence. I was a crewman aboard a ship out of Arnos. We were hit by a storm and driven south. Then the ship went under and I was washed upon your shore.
Nepalo simu in Arnos.
Lord Mulcibar translated into Akeshian.
Anu ulukur.
What was your vessel's mission?
We were carrying soldiers to Etonia to fight the heathen.
Yes? To fight whom?
Your people, my lord.
Horani shomakek alata Etonia saratum.
Azana Nepal.
Lord Mulcibar turned back to Horus.
Her radiant majesty asks if you know where Lord Isiratu was taking you before I arrived. Be aware that the other slaves have already been interrogated, and any lie will be punished most harshly.
I think it was Nisa or something like that.
Do you mean Nisus?
Yes, that's it.
Asar Nisus.
Is ulkor alaktasa asar Nisus inap...
The queen lifted a finger, and Isiratu shut his mouth. The queen's expression remained neutral, and still lovely.
Are you quite sure? Lord Isiratu was taking you to the city of Nisus?
That's what I was told. Something about giving us to a temple?
Horus couldn't make out enough to give him any idea of what was being discussed.
Sir, poor my lord.
Yet by their expressions and the heated look on Isiratu's face, it was something bad. Finally, the queen stood up.
Harani sa Isiratu alaktasa. Minat inazama katia. Kanu zoaniai sushoma kalata hekatatum shomana.
Two soldiers came forth and flanked Lord Isiratu. The nobleman bowed to the queen and then walked away with the soldiers. His son and Nasir followed behind. As he was escorted out, Lord Isiratu shot a hard glance at Horus. Ubar nodded to him as if nothing had happened. Nasir ignored him completely.
What just happened?
Lord Isiratu has been found guilty of disloyalty to the crown. He is stripped of lands and title and will henceforth be demoted to the Hecatatum caste.
What are Heca... whatever you said.
They are the warrior society of Akeshia. It is not a dishonorable path for those of common birth, but for a Zoanii such as Isiratu...
What will happen to his family?
Most will accompany him in his lesser station. His heir, Lord Uba, may be taken in by another Zoanii family as a ward. With time and patience, he may yet achieve a dignified rank.
Kimani palu simuim?
Her glorious radiance wishes to hear your account of the storm that struck Lord Isiratu's caravan.
Horus told the story as best he was able to remember until he got to the part where Isiratu fell.
With all honesty, I can't explain what happened after that. I felt a surge of energy, like my heart was going to burst. Then the next thing I knew, the storm was gone.
As Lord Mulcibar interpreted, the queen watched Horus with a fierce intensity that made him uncomfortable. The old men seated on the platform's middle tier spoke among themselves. The queen appeared about to say something, but suddenly, people parted, making way for a tall man in a silver breastplate over a purple silk chiton. His complexion was darker than many in the crowd, almost coppery. His hair and eyebrows were jet black. He wore a sword at his side. The tall man threw his words at the throne, even as he stared in Horus's direction.
That is Prince Zazil, brother to the queen and commander of the royal legion. He has asked why the savage foreigner, you, has been allowed into this hallowed hall. And her majesty replied that she wished to see you in person.
I take it he doesn't like my people much.
Considering that his highness has spent the last several years fighting on the frontier, I surmise you would be correct. Tread carefully, Master Horus. The prince is not one to cross.
Isu uluko, alaktasa parsi salak.
When the queen spoke, the prince fell silent, though he cast a menacing glare at Horus. Horace noticed that Lord Mulcibar subtly inched forward, placing himself between Horace and the prince.
Kimne pa lusimu im?
Mulcibar bowed before translating.
The prince has expressed a wish to test the foreign devil, you again, in a duel. But the queen is more interested in hearing your story. Her Majesty asks, how can she be sure you are not a spy? Your arrival on our shores, the lone survivor of your ship, is very convenient, not to mention your abilities.
Please tell Her Majesty that I am only a shipwright. If there's something special about me, I did not know it before I arrived in your land, and I would happily depart back to my own country if she would permit it.
The nobleman raised an eyebrow, but he translated without any trace of ire that Horace could detect.
Menat in Asama, Napalo Simu inabitum.
Asarulukur pulmaleb.
As the queen talked to Lord Mulcibar, she gestured to Horace.
The queen says she will take your request under advisement. In the meantime, she wishes to further discuss your role in the quelling of the storm. When you say that the power surged... Oh.
Lord Mulcibar stopped talking and looked back toward the main doors, where a group of bald men stood on the threshold. By their body language, straightened shoulders, lifted chins, mouths pinched into firm lines, they appeared like they were about to plunge into battle. The man in front of the group had wide shoulders and a powerful chest contained within a pale gold robe that contrasted with his bronze skin. Vivid red and indigo tattoos covered his scalp. He held a wooden staff topped by a golden orb, a sun by its look, complete with a corona of sharp rays. The men standing behind him were clad in deep red robes like those Horace had seen elsewhere in the city. They were priests. Horace looked to Nasir with his bald, tattooed head and realized he was a priest too. The new arrivals approached the throne. The robust priest in front stopped just a few feet from the bottom step. While the queen's gaze rested on the priests, she spoke to Lord Mulcibar. The nobleman bowed and turned, limping from the hall. The guards closed in around Horace and indicated he should follow Lord Mulcibar out of the hall. He did so. Looking over his shoulder, he watched as the tattooed man addressed the queen while she sat rigid on her throne. Lord Mulcibar remained silent as they left the hall. The huge doors closed behind them, and the nobleman started walking down the corridor leading away from the grand hall. Horace made to follow, but the soldiers surrounded him, cutting off his avenues of escape. With their spears, they gestured toward a branching passage.
My lord? What's happened?
But Mulcibar kept walking, leaving him with the soldiers.